Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 2:41 p.m. That is Central Time. Today is April 28th. I thought we'd kick off with the yen. It continues to trend lower, and this has been consecutive weeks on the downside. So we're certainly seeing a short-term oversold condition, but at the same time, there's no evidence that it is over because more than any other factor, Japan appears to be sticking to its guns. They are in no mood to join the commonality that we're seeing right across the board in just about every other central bank around the world, other than in China, that they want to reduce the size of their respective balance sheets and begin to raise interest rates to try and head off inflation. Of course, Japan has been trying to create inflation for decades, so they're grasping this opportunity with both hands, and they have committed themselves to continue to adopt this yield curve control policy. So the JGB yield, they continue to defend it at 25 basis points, and it's been up and down a bit over the last couple of days, but plenty of evidence that the Bank of Japan is still defending this level. So this is continuing to put downward pressure on the yen. It's also, of course, boosting the outlook or the profitability of Japanese exporters while enhancing the cost of everything that they import. So obviously, oil is a big component for Japan because it's an energy importer. Now, the Nikkei is beginning to respond, but it has to be, I think this performance has to be put into perspective because obviously the currency has been going down and going down hard. So that has definitely taken a toll on Japanese equities from the perspective of an international investor. And we can see that this has been a really pronounced decline overall. Now, when we then think about what this means for everybody else in Asia, so when the Chinese are looking across the strait at the improving competitiveness of Japanese exports, well, now we can see that the yen is right in the region of the lows relative to the renminbi that we've seen over the course of the last decade. And this is also contributing to some effort by Japan, by China to devalue their currency. Now, there are a lot of other moving parts, and China needs a weaker currency. You can't continue to have a strong currency and also stimulate the economy, because stimulation generally means printing more of the currency. And obviously, if they're going to stimulate, well, then they're not going to be raising interest rates. And but I think this is also one of the more important points, that Japan is suddenly becoming much more competitive relative to China. And this, of course, is equally true for South Korea. So Japan and South Korea compete in many of the same markets. So we're also starting to see some efforts underway by South Korea to devalue their currency. Now, when we think about the Taiwan dollar, well, Taiwanese exports have done especially well, but they're also devaluing their currency. So when China and Japan are devaluing their currencies, then everybody else in Asia is going to do exactly the same thing. So this is an additional contributing factor to why the Asia dollar index has been trending downwards in a very profound manner over the last 2 weeks. But it's, of course, also contributing to the strength in the US dollar. And the Bloomberg dollar index is now back up into the upper side of the range that's persisted for the last 7 years. And then when we think more about the euro weighted conventional dollar index, it pushed on to a new recovery high in here today. Now, this has been a very profound move. It looked like it was going to break down in early 2021. Then we had a couple of good upper dynamics, a retest of the low, and it really hasn't looked back since. But we're very overbought in the short term. But the big question then is, what would happen or what needs to happen for the Federal Reserve to begin to dial back on their determination to raise rates? Well, US growth this last quarter was negative. Estimates were that it would be positive by about 1%, but it came in nearly 240 basis points below consensus. So there are a couple of different factors. One obviously is that comparisons are tend to be year over year, and that's how GDP is reported. And GDP growth last year was particularly firm. So there's a tendency in GDP figures to occasionally throw out one negative quarter. And there's a clear consensus that the next quarter will return to growth. So while there's been a lot of talk about recessions, then investors don't really think that this is the beginning of a recession. And I would agree that it's not the beginning of a recession, but it is indicative of slowing growth. And we're likely to continue to see slowing growth and patchy economic activity. The one thing that's quite clear is that there, even though financial conditions have tightened, and because we've had a correction in stock markets, then that has contributed to financial conditions tightening even further. But the stock market started to firm today. And one thing that I've seen plenty of evidence of, at least in my personal life, is lots of money sloshing around and lots of money being thrown at consumers, whether it's in terms of buy now, pay later, or auto loans. There's just been a cacophony of activity throwing money at consumers. And is it therefore little wonder that we have an inflationary pressure? So the Federal Reserve is going to begin to reduce the size of its balance sheet, and that's going to also tighten up liquidity. And financial conditions now are about as tight as they were before the pandemic, and they had been tightening all the way through 2019. So they'd been easing all the way through 2019. They had tightened all the way through 2018. And it's from here on out that we should start to notice some of the tightening measures, which suggests that some of the buy now, pay later type of operations will become less prevalent. The availability of liquidity will be less easy to attain, and credit standards will start to become more or tighter, and interest rates will go up, or the duration of loans offered will ease back. So obviously, these are significant potential issues. Then I think it's also rather interesting that there's been a great deal of questioning about the availability of stuff. And one thing that I think is interesting is you go to the store, and I was in a store yesterday evening, looking for quarter rounds for the baseboards, for baseboards in my home, and they had 20 in stock. And the next door over, when they looked, I needed 128 of them, and there isn't 128 pieces of quarter round of a uniform shape and size and color in 100 mile radius of that store, despite the fact that there are at least 10 additional stores. So we're at a point where inventory, manufacturing and trade inventories are still at highs that hadn't been seen previously. But still, we see this kind of condition where there's just not available inventory for a lot of the things that people want to buy. For example, it's still very difficult to buy lead, or sorry, not lead-based, oil-based paints. And of course, that is very much tied to the refining process and oil. But at the same time, these are two incompatible trends, where on the one hand, you have unavailable inventory, and then you have reported inventories being close to record highs. So that suggests that there must be some explanation. And what I've seen, at least what I've been doing, is buying from multiple locations. And the one then that can deliver fastest, then I take that, and then I cancel the orders. And because there's interest-free financing, then it's easy to put up tens of thousands of dollars in credit card payments without ever having to pay anything, because the order is cancelled before the first payment becomes due. So this is boosting sales data. It's necessitating that companies order more inventory, but ultimately, I'm only going to take delivery of one. So then there's going to be lots of spare inventory around. And I suspect that there's a lot of this type of activity going on. So it's inflating some of the sales data. So I thought it was interesting that Visa reported that their sales were really quite firm this quarter. And this is obviously beneficial for Visa. And the share is at least holding the region of the $200 area, and it's bounced from the 1,000-day moving average. So we've definitely seen some big upper dynamics within this range, and it supports the view that this is support building rather than a distribution. And Facebook returned to positive numbers as well. So the share has sold off exceptionally aggressively, but then bounced really quite emphatically in here today. So it's looking like potentially now a failed downside break. So at least some evidence of support building beginning to come back in here. And if it can sustain a move back above that 1,000-day moving average, well, then that will be very supportive of the view that we've seen a buying opportunity. But it's got a lot of work to do between now and then. Now, when we think about the wider economy, then, I continue to think that we're going to see slowing growth. But with the stock market a bit steadier on stronger earnings, particularly from Facebook, then bond yields were in positive territory today. But we've already had an awfully big move in bond yields. And if I'm correct, and there's absolutely there's no guarantee that I am, but I do think that the economy is probably weaker than the headline figures are showing, then bonds are very oversold. And this 3% level has been an area of resistance on multiple occasions over the last year. Now, gold has been selling off, but it was in positive territory today. Now, it didn't close above the $1,900 area just yet. But we are in the region of the upper side of the underlying trading range, and it hasn't quite failed yet to sustain this breakout. In fact, we would really have to see a midpoint danger line stop taken out, and I don't believe that that's going to happen. I think it's much more likely that investors are going to begin to price in the scope that there might not be quite so many interest rate hikes in the next year, and that that would then help to support gold. Now, oil prices are obviously going to be one of the things that people continue to pay attention to. Now, we can see here on this chart over the last 2 months that we have a sequence of higher reaction lows. Now, they're very incremental, but they are rising. We also have a very clear sequence of lower rally highs. So we're coming back now towards the most recent one of those lower highs. And if it can sustain a move through the peak put in the middle of April, then it's likely that we'll come back up and test the peak around $140. Now, of course, there are a lot of moving parts in the the global outlook right now, because we have the uncertainty about Russia. And they're certainly taking aim at countries like Poland and Bulgaria that aren't really in a strong position to fight back. And then you have the question about how is Europe going to be able to afford to cut off payments for natural gas? Now, natural gas was in positive territory earlier today, but then reversed it. So we're still in this consolidation following the breakout to new recovery highs, and it's certainly going to have to hold the move above $6 if this breakout is to be sustained and to really confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. UK natural gas prices have been very range-bound and exceptionally volatile, but they are also now testing the lower side of this range, and we're in negative territory the last, or today, barely. But the question is, are we going to see inventory build in Europe? And will they try and max out their storage capacity before the winter? Because this is obviously part of Russia's calculus, that they believe that if they weather the summer and they start to cut off supplies now, that by the time it comes to winter, they'll have Europe between a rock and a hard place. So we're at a rather critical juncture here for inventory builds right across Europe. And of course, it's going to create demand for alternatives. Now, the uranium sector has been rather range-bound over the last 6 months, but it's beginning to steady from the region of the 200-day moving average. And there's a lot more interest and concrete moves underway by South Korea in particular to be the global center for small modular reactor construction. And that's likely to be an impressive part of the future of the global energy mix. Now, then I think it's also interesting that the Brookfield Renewable Partners fund rebounded really impressively earlier this year and has given up about half of it. And this is part of the solar sector that isn't nearly as levered as some of the solar panel installers on residential homes, because they primarily own utility scale operations. And then I think it's also interesting that we've had technological innovation in the geothermal sector, and there's really only one share in that sector, and it's firming from the region of the upper side of its range that's been forming for the last couple of years. So there's going to be opportunities in renewable energy, and but I think we're going to see a significant differentiation between those that are very interest rate sensitive and those that aren't. It's the utility scale type operations that are likely to do best. Now, the solar sector generally is beginning to demonstrate some support, and it is holding the low around the 1,000-day moving average. So there's the potential here that it does hold and that it will do better from here. But that would very much be predicated on bond yields pausing and perhaps pulling back down. Because if we start to see interest rates decline, well, then obviously the most interest rate sensitive portions of the market should do better. And perhaps that's also why the Nasdaq was doing better in here today, because investors are looking to buy the dip and giving some credence to the view that perhaps bond yields have gone a little bit too far too fast, because it's certainly a consensus right now. And I've been writing about it today, but after tennis last night, there's two of us are in the work in the financial industry, and one of the other players was asking us what our opinion was on owning TIPS with short maturities as part of a college savings plan. And what I thought was particularly interesting was that among the group, there was this palpable just resignation that inflation is going to continue and that it's going to get worse, and that by leaving money in cash, one is being robbed. So, therefore, it's just inevitable that somebody has to find something to preserve their purchasing power from inflation. So, of course, that's contributing to purchase plans. People are accelerating purchases of physical stuff, but they're also then trying to save and to avoid holding cash. And that, of course, is helping to support asset prices generally. But it's also fanning the determination of central banks to raise rates and to reduce the size of their balance sheets. And the one thing we know is that every time that reducing the size of the balance sheet has been tried, it has resulted in deflation. So I think that it is quite likely that by the time we get to the end of this year and into next year, we're going to be much more worried about deflationary forces than inflationary forces. Because after we have gone through $700 billion of tightening by the Federal Reserve, that's equal to how much tightening they performed in 2018. And that also represented a very significant tightening of financial conditions, and we had a couple of sizable pullbacks in the stock market. Now, we are now seeing the short-term oversold condition likely to be unwound, and then I think it's likely that the sustainability of that rebound is going to be very much dependent on just whether central banks relent from an aggressive pace of interest rate hiking. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.